Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 29th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm really looking forward to this week's episode. I know I say that every week, but I mean it every week. If I weren't looking forward to it, I probably wouldn't be doing these interviews. But before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is because of the support from my listeners just like you, those of you who go above and beyond to make sure that we can continue this show. So this week, I want to thank my top patrons on www.patreon.com/talknerdy. They include Phil T-Bear, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Hormiu Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewall. Thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart. And if you want to hear your name at the top of the show, again, just go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support. Anything above $25 will give you a weekly shout out. All right, guys, this week is a great one. I got to sit down with a good friend and somebody who I really admire. We worked together on a previous project, but now she's in the big leagues. Her name's Kelly Loudenberg. She is an incredible director, producer, all-around filmmaker. She's also an incredible journalist. And one of her most recent projects, you may have even come across it on Netflix, is called The Confession Tapes. It's a documentary series that investigates cases where people who were convicted of murder claim that their confessions were coerced. It's, I think, an important one. It's just like a deep, meaningful topic. It really matters when it comes to social justice. And even though it's not ostensibly a topic that we would usually talk about on a science show, I do think that there are some important themes that come up about junk science in the courtroom, things that we know now about forensic evidence that maybe it doesn't hold quite as much weight, certain aspects of it, as it should. Anyway, there's a lot to dig into. If you've seen the show, you're going to love this. If you haven't, it's definitely going to make you want to see the show. So without any further ado, here she is, Kelly Loudenberg. So Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Kara.
It's been a while.
I know. How long has it been?
I don't know. 2 years? Can it be that long?
I think it's been longer.
No, really? It might have been. 3 years?
Maybe 3 years.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So we just caught up. So we're not going to subject you guys to all of the catching up that we did at the restaurant before we got together. But I'm really excited to talk to you, A, because I'm excited to catch up with you and hear about all the cool work you've been doing. But B, because I want to talk to you about your newest project on Netflix. It's a weird thing about living in LA, but it's not just about living in LA, because I've worked with you before, but it's always a weird thing when you see something really great and you're like, that was amazing. And then you're like, I know the person who made that.
Yeah, that's happened to me a few times with friends of mine.
Well, it happened on this series. So Kelly and I worked previously on a short series for Vice and GE. And you are amazing. You're an amazing woman director because you also hire a full woman like crew. It was the first time in my life I've ever worked where it was female talent, female DP, which is the camera person, female BCAM, and female AP and director.
Yeah, it was all women except for the sound network executives.
Oh, yeah, the network executives. And sometimes there'd be a sound guy, poor sound guy.
Sometimes. But we tried to get some women in there.
Yeah, we did.
Sound.
We did a lot. Lots of times when you travel, sound is local. Like we're traveling a lot. So you travel with the core crew, so that was all by design, obviously. That was your choice.
Right.
Have you done it since then, or do you?
Yeah, and I did. I tried to do it again with this show.
Really?
Yeah, we were a female-led crew, and usually the only guy was the sound person.
Yeah.
But I only had one DP. She took care of two cameras. But we also had an AC that helped, and that was really great. And that was another woman that would travel with us. And then my producer was a woman, and me. It was a pretty small crew. It was smaller than when we went, when we were traveling together.
So so for people who don't know, an AC is assistant camera?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they help them, like, build the camera and, like, go get lights and get all the things they need. Yeah, swap out lenses.
Exactly, like yeah. And the two different AC, female ACs that we worked with were extremely talented, so they could also shoot.
Yeah.
They would sometimes work on the other camera.
I actually just did a shoot today, which I can't talk about what it is yet, but they hired an AC because it was easier to get an AC hired through the network than a B-cam. But
oh, really?
The AC just did B-cam.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the way to go. I mean, for me, I prefer my DP feel supported, and she mm-hmm. has people that she likes to work with, and they kind of nerd out on the camera. And
they have a shorthand, right?
Yeah. Like
they work with each other well. And DP, of course, is the director of photography.
Right.
So that's the person who makes everything look real pretty.
Exactly.
And you, I mean, historically, you're a director, but of course you have to also produce
right.
when you're making a documentary, right? Like
right.
you have to wear a lot of hats.
Right.
This documentary is huge on Netflix. Okay, I've already introduced it at this point. I always time travel on the show and it's very confusing. So I've already told everybody the documentary, but the confession tapes, it's like, it's huge. It's like always in your recommended. It's trending like on the front page all the time. I mention it to people and they're like, oh, I totally watched that. And I'm like, holy shit, that's my friend Kelly's.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, it's funny because I don't get to hear that perspective.
I don't really...
We didn't have any PR or marketing at all for the show, so I kind of felt like I was in some weird void where my friends watched it. And, you know, the funny thing was it took some time. It took some time for people to find it. And because it wasn't advertised, people just had to find it through word of mouth or social media or friends or the algorithm.
Yeah, it's probably my algorithm.
It probably is, yeah. I mean, they Netflix puts a lot of weight in the algorithm, mm-hmm. so... I'm sure that it did a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah. So if anybody else on Netflix is watching a lot of like true crime or they're watching a lot of documentaries on a regular, I just watch
a lot of
like,
you do?
Yeah, a lot of social justice and social commentary documentaries.
Right.
So of course it fits right into my wheelhouse. And that's what you do. Like that's what you love to do, right?
Yeah. It has a social message. But for me, I was interested in psychology and this idea of our memory being, you know, a malleable thing that it's easy to go in and manipulate someone's versions of events or whatever, somebody's narrative. So I was interested in it for a lot of that, for those reasons. Mm-hmm. But then when I really began to learn how systemic the problem was, that mm-hmm. I really felt like it was a story that hadn't been told as comprehensively as I could. I could tell it, you know, there has been some really amazing reporting and great documentaries, but they're just one-offs, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought if I could just do something kind of bigger, it might send a message about
absolutely
that.
Yeah. So I guess for people who haven't seen it yet, it's always hard for me because I never know how much to say and how much to leave out so that they can discover it later. But Confession Tapes is literally that. It's a docuseries, but they're like standalones,
right?
Individual stories about people who were wrongfully convicted, or maybe they weren't, we don't know. But either way, what we do know is that those confessions were coerced.
Right.
They were either manufactured or they were produced through kind of means that shouldn't, I don't think, be legal, sometimes mm-hmm. aren't legal. The very first episode, it's a Canadian story. And so it's a very mm-hmm. different situation than what would be okay within our justice system here in the United States. But every episode after that, I mean, it happened here in the U.S.
Right. And that it's mostly using the Reed technique, which is a very popular, I never called it by name, mm-hmm. but I think anyone that works within our criminal justice system recognizes that technique. And it's being kind of phased out of a lot of police departments now across the United States because they realize that it's problematic and it leads to false confessions. But it basically starts with an assumption of guilt. Mm. And it can use some pretty dirty tactics like lying about evidence and lying about witnesses and a lot of psychological tricks that can get someone to confess. So that was primarily the issue, the sort of my main issue I had with how these interrogations were conducted. It was with the Reed technique itself, with the technique that's like endorsed by so many police departments and that I think should be retired, these techniques.
Is there a definition behind it or does the Reed technique encompass all of these different kind of coercive strategies?
It's a methodology. It's a textbook.
Okay.
And I read the whole textbook when I was preparing for the show because you can, by reading the textbook, you can recognize where the techniques are used mm-hmm. when you watch the interrogations. But in fact, I watched a lot of tapes that didn't make it in the show. And so I started to notice patterns and I talked to a lot of false confession experts. So I was reading academic papers. So I was beginning to see, to kind of almost become like an expert myself and to recognize false confessions. Mm. And it was the Reed technique again and again that was creating the situation for that to happen. So And yeah, the textbook is, it's pretty, I mean, it spells it out for you. Ugh. So it's pretty brazen, actually, if you ask me.
Did they just not realize when it was written, or did they not care that the end result of using coercive techniques is going to be a coerced confession? Or was there just always this idea? Because I think that's the quote you see more times than not throughout the docuseries, is people saying something along the lines of, well, if you didn't do it, why would you confess?
Right.
Did they just think, no matter what you do, nobody's going to confess to a crime they didn't commit?
I think they genuinely had that belief. Mm-hmm. I think they thought that innocent people don't confess to a crime they would commit. They didn't think they would do it, and they didn't think that it happens.
Which makes sense, because I don't think I would, and you don't think you would, but now we know under the right circumstances, we absolutely would.
Right. And I sort of started out with that premise, I guess a premise of like empathy and like, okay, if this happened to me, you know, if I was in the room with this guy, mm-hmm. if I just lost my daughter, or if I had just drank a case of beer, or, you know, all of these things, or even if I was completely, you know, sober and just sitting there for 14 hours in a tiny room without food, how would my story start to change? How might I become tricked? And it's not that hard. So,
yeah, something that really fascinated me was the number of times, and I think you see this time and time again, but the number of times where people would actually verbalize things like, I don't remember doing it,
right,
and I don't think I did it, but you say my DNA was there, so I must have done it.
Right.
So then they start rewriting their own memory to try and come up with some sort of plausible way that they did it without knowing.
Right.
It's so, like, maybe it was a dream, or maybe I was just so drunk, or maybe I was just being reactive and my mind has blocked it out, because you're telling me you have evidence. And it's like this trust in authority to people who don't have the education about, for example, lie detector tests.
Right.
Like, they don't know. There's a reason lie detector tests are not admissible in court.
Yeah.
Because they don't detect lies. They detect like physiological representations of anxiety.
Yes. And that's it. And it's very easily manipulated and also just easily mistaken. I mean, that's the thing I found a lot too, was that even though the lie detector is not admissible, it was used to get the confession, which is admissible. And so in a lot of those cases, and even ones we didn't include, the context is, come take a lie detector test. Mm-hmm. If you're innocent, we'll clear you. It'll clear you. You can go home. This will be done.
They always say that, right? We want to exclude you.
We want to exclude you. We just need to get this done. And, you know, maybe the cops aren't lying. Maybe the results look like they failed, even though I'm not even sure what that would look like. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you necessarily can fail one of those tests.
Pretty subjective.
Yeah, it's very subjective. So, but it just starts to confuse people, and they don't think that technology or science lies. So once that's there in front of them, then they really get confused, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, not to be like on a soapbox about the kind of stuff I talk about on the show a lot, but that's, I think, just more evidence pointing to why it's so important that we be scientifically literate, mm-hmm. because you end up with one or two, well, you end up with a lot of different outcomes, but when you really don't understand that science is a process and what science is, this attempt to explain the world, that it's not just these books that were passed down from on high, it's not, you know, this like really reified dogmatic information. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand it and you actually think it is those things, you're either going to blindly trust scientific authorities, mm-hmm. not even realizing that within the scientific community, people disagree, or you're going to blindly distrust them and be like a conspiratorial thinker. But both of those things are bad, mm-hmm. you know? But when you understand that science is science, it's a process, it's flawed, but it's the kind of best thing that we have, and let's mm-hmm. look at multiple lines of evidence and blah, 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 you'll start to get a good picture. But I mean, that's the saddest part for me, is seeing these people who are like, well, I failed the test and the test measures lies. I must have been lying.
Right. And a lot of times these police officers introduce themselves as scientists or doctors. You not only have like the authority of a police officer, but you have someone saying they're a scientist, or, you know, and that happened in a couple of those.
Wow.
So I think it is the belief in authority. Cops don't lie. A scientist isn't going to lie. They're not going to lie to me. So, like, what interest do they have in manipulating me this way? And I think that maybe the police officers, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt, like, maybe they just have a case of tunnel vision and they you know, believe they got the right person. I don't know if it's malicious, but it becomes malicious by, you know, willfully ignoring other evidence or other leads. So,
and it's also such, it's kind of the definition of junk science or bad science is making your mind up before you collect the data,
right,
instead of collecting the data in kind of an agnostic way, you know, trying not to make any assumptions. And then at the end, looking at how the data pan out.
Right. Or when they're in those situations, it's like they just make everything fit that the narrative that they get into in that confession. I mean, for me, well, that's what tunnel vision or confirmation bias is. It's like, without looking at the whole, you know, you get a piece of it and everything has to somehow connect back to that, or everything has to support that. And it ends up that you re-spin the story, or you sort of rewrite it, and it's not the true version. And so for me, I wanted to go back and look at these like stories which were really kind of cemented in time and just sort of in the public record, but also in the media. And they were just stories that there was no question that it happened this way, you know? And where the original document that came about was that interrogation. So I wanted to take that archival document and rewind it. So each episode has to use a tape. Each episode uses the tape as like a springboard to kind of weave out other narratives. And so we were trying to, even taking the movie Thin Blue Line as a big reference, or Rashomon, we were trying to kind of look back and say, well, if something else happened, what could have happened and how might it have happened and what wasn't followed up on or whatever. So that was sort of the conceptual idea. And those tapes are harder to find than you might think.
I was going to ask about that because you seem to have this incredible access to this like raw footage. It's the actual tape of the interrogation room. And you must have watched, I mean, it's like 14 hours.
A lot of
just it. To get the confession. Like you right. must have been trying to watch as much of that as you could. Like so much time and so much energy and probably emotional energy spent doing that.
Yeah.
But how do you even get these kinds of things?
Well, the thing that's tricky, and there are other shows now, there's like a show on Discovery called The Interrogation Room. I don't want to promote that, but like they're basically looking at interrogation tapes.
Yeah.
And I think interrogation tapes where something went really wrong are maybe harder to find.
Oh yeah, those are conveniently lost or taped over.
Or buried. It's like, well, how do you parse out like who's really a criminal and who's not? And so for me, it was just so much research. It was layers and layers of research. And it was a year of research before I ever approached Netflix.
Wow.
So it was a lot of like lonely me working with another researcher, which thank goodness I had some amazing, you know, friends that could help. But a lot of it was just like talking to people, following up on leads, and then talking to Steve Drizin, who works at the Center on Wrongful Convictions and is one of Brendan Dassey's attorneys in Making a Murder. And he became like a really big mentor of mine and is an expert on false confessions and gave me a bunch of cases to start with.
Oh,
so he
great.
Gave me a handful of cases and he said, you know, get to work on these. And, and so I started looking through those. And some of those people got exonerated in the process. So we didn't feature them in the show.
Yeah, because one part of the show that's hard, I think, for some people is that, you know, a lot of modern American TV, everything gets tied up in a nice little bow and there's a happy ending. And you know, that's not real life. And this show is much more reflective of real life.
Right. And I'm so glad you say that. Like, for me, that was a really important part of it. It was that there are probably, you know, hundreds of people sitting in prison who confessed where there's no record and they claim their confession is false. They don't have DNA. They don't have any evidence to go back to. And the Innocence Project is never going to pick up their case. So they have no hope. And this could be from confessions or from junk science or from eyewitness misidentification, from so many things that went wrong. So just knowing the sheer number of possibly innocent people who won't ever have a happy ending, because, you know, we read in the news these stories, so-and-so was exonerated after 25 years or so-and-so's out after, you know, they found the DNA. That doesn't happen that often. And that only happens after so much hard work from lawyers.
And the sad thing is, even that is not really a happy ending. Because, I mean, it's the best possible ending, but they're usually not compensated. Many times they can't adjust to the outside world. It's like they've been changed.
It's tragic.
Yeah, it's really tragic.
Yeah, so those aren't happy endings either.
Yeah.
But the fact that they even had a lawyer is optimistic. And absolutely. I think like some of the cases that I took, they didn't have, you know, active representation.
Or they've gone through all the appeals.
No, they've gone through all their appeals or whatever. I mean, yeah. Thankfully everyone had a good support group because we had to have people to interview. But even there were some cases that I really believed in, but that there was not a lot of people to talk to about it, or no media coverage, or no record of it. So like, maybe there's an audio tape, and maybe, you know, I strongly believe that this person has been wrongfully convicted, but like, what am I going to edit with?
Exactly. You know? Yeah. You're a documentarian. You're not a podcaster.
Yeah. So. Some of it's good for podcasts, actually.
That is tough, though. I mean, one thing that really surprises me, speaking of all of the kind of media that you have to comb through and piece together, because that's another thing that I think you do brilliantly as a documentarian, is you don't rely heavily on VO or on title cards. You use them really title cards you use minimally, and there's no VO in this story. So it's actually the speech of the individual interviews that you have to painstakingly thread together to tell a story, which is not that's not the easy way. That's the hard way to do it. And you take that road. And I think it makes for a much more compelling story because it's always in the words of the people who were involved. But beyond that, I think that one thing that kind of never ceases to amaze me is when these coercive, let's say, police officers or detectives or whoever the people who were involved, who I think, like you said, benefit of the doubt, principle of charity, maybe didn't realize that what they were doing was coercion. How many of them were willing to go on camera even decades later and be like, yeah, I didn't do anything wrong?
In the show, I
did. Yeah, like you interviewed multiple cops and multiple interrogators who are like totally blind to the fact that they did anything wrong.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And also, how did you keep your cool during those interviews?
Oh, yeah, with some pep talks, I guess. Yeah, it was hard. That was hard. And I wanted to get their side of the story because I tried to make the show as objective as possible.
It's very balanced.
Yeah. And I really was being honest when I approached them and saying, like, look, I really do want to know, like, how did you see it? What was your investigation like? Like, how did you collect this information? Where, you know, I really wanted to find out from them the details of the case. So I was being completely authentic in getting those interviews, and I didn't want to exploit anybody. And in fact, there were a lot of cops that had agreed to interview and then dropped out.
That's what I would expect. I would expect more people to be like, I don't want to go on camera about this. But you had so many cops and so many prosecutors who, you're right, and also who are intelligent people. Like, these aren't yokels. These are, like, really bright people who did make good arguments. And, you know, if you only saw their side of the story, you would be like, yeah, I get it. But then you see the tapes.
Right. So, I mean, it just shows you that's the thing that kind of blew my mind about the concept in general. It's that here I was, like, looking at the case. I didn't live in this town. I didn't go to the trial. I don't know these people. I come to it 25 years later and then look at it. And I look at it through the archival media, through case documents, and through news media. And so I'm piecing together my own version of what happened. And maybe they are right. Maybe there is something to what they're saying. So, I mean, they're intelligent people. So I wanted to, like, hear their side of it because I was seeing it one way and they see it another. But, like, why do they see it that way when I see it so differently? But it is like the, you know, Rashomon, you know, with different versions of what happened. And is there an objective truth? And I think the more you look into it, the more you wonder if there is or not. Maybe multiple things happened. Yeah. I don't know if that's getting into other theories, but it's just some of it was just so dense and convoluted and hard to parse out, you know, and they were just so stuck in believing that it happened this one way.
And that always is a red flag for me, I think, just as a, you know, I'm skeptical about everything. And so, of course, I think that's why some of this true crime stuff really interests me, because when nobody knows what happened except for the victim who's no longer with us and the perpetrator, whoever that perpetrator may be, whether it's the person who's on trial or not, only they know the truth. So we have to use tools, basically, to piece together as close to what the truth is as possible. We're never going to really know. We're just going to get as close as we can. like you said, like, what is there an objective truth if two people experience that objective truth differently?
Right.
But there is a big difference between, did this person actually commit a crime or not? You know, like, did this person light a house on fire? Right. Did this person raise up a gun and shoot somebody with it? Or did they not? I think that's partially why it's such a compelling story as a viewer.
Yeah.
To be able to sit there and be your own detective and try and figure it out. And kind of say, oh, well, I do understand where that guy's coming from. I see why he would do it that way. But then this other guy, is that really a fair thing? But again, I have to come back to this idea that, like, it is really counterintuitive that somebody would admit to a crime that they didn't commit. It's a really hard thing for us as viewers. And I think it's probably a really hard thing for jurors to fathom.
Or police officers.
Yeah.
Maybe that was just it. I mean, maybe they, like, that just sealed, that was just like, okay. I mean, maybe you just have to rethink that whole idea in general. Yeah, I mean, it is like a really, it's like a suicide. It's like a self-harm thing. Mm-hmm. It's counterintuitive. Like, why would you want to do something that hurts yourself? What's the point of that?
Because in the moment, it doesn't seem like it does, right? Because they create this, like, incredibly... It's funny because you talked about empathy at the very beginning of the conversation and your attempt as a documentarian to approach these things with empathy. And then you see the tapes and you get this weird sense of, like, feigned empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the cops are trying to make the person think they're empathizing with them so that they'll feel safe and open up to them. But it's all an act.
Right.
It's all a ploy.
It's really, really disgusting.
It is. Yeah. Like, the things they'll say kind of, I feel you, you know, you must have just been so tired, and your wife. I mean, I've wanted to beat my wife too before. Who hasn't wanted to beat their wife? You know, it's this gross thing where they just try to maintain this really intense sense of sort of connection.
Camaraderie. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's minimizing. I think in the Reed book, it's like called maximization and minimization, but they'll just try to kind of downplay the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you did kill her, it was in the heat of the moment and it was reactionary or where it's protecting yourself. What's that called?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, defensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like I know you didn't really mean it.
Right. And so, but did you do it? Or, and then the other one is minimization, where it's like, it's okay if you hit your wife. Like, we all do that.
Yeah.
Or if you did that in the heat of the moment, you're not a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a bad person for doing that. You're not a bad person for hating your mom, or you're not a bad person for wanting to, you know, blow the house up or whatever. I mean, it's just for them, like, giving them a moral out.
Yeah.
And that's what they do a lot, which, coming from a police officer, you're a little confused by. Why would you tell me that it's okay if I do these things? Like, you don't think less of me for doing these things.
And so, it humanizes the police officer,
right.
Makes them less threatening.
Right.
Right? So then it's even safer now for me to talk to him man to man.
Right.
And tell him about these demons inside me. It's so sad. And then, of course, a lot of these people, not always, sometimes these people are really well educated. Because again, it could happen to you. It could happen to me. It could happen to anybody listening to this podcast. But often, these are maybe low-income people, individuals who don't mm-hmm. have good representation, individuals who have had experience with the criminal justice system before. They're living in places where it's not uncommon
mm-hmm.
to be arrested.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's like we've been talking about that kind of off camera. We're off camera right now, off microphone, just about the really bad problems we have with inequality in our social justice or our criminal justice system and our social justice system, you know, that like there's an expectation too, as good as you may be, if you're a young Black man from the inner city, like, you're probably going to go to prison.
Yeah. You have it's just true.
A good chance of going to prison in your life, even if you never did anything wrong.
Which makes me not believe so much in free will.
Yeah.
At that point, it's like, what kind of conditions are we creating that are...
Yeah, it's almost it's a prescribed outcome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard, right? Because...
Well, the deck is just stacked so high.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
It's stacked so high. It's like, it's hard to blame people. It's just really fucked up, the whole thing.
And the character assassination, like, that's something that I notice a lot, is really like a big injustice. Is not only, let's say you have an example, like one of the examples in your stories of somebody who has a coerced confession, where there's actually probably somebody else who committed this crime that nobody's looking into. So now we've got an actual violent criminal who's just out there able to commit more crimes. That's neither here nor there. But this person who potentially did not commit this crime, who has been coerced, broken down over the course of 18 hours, you know, and made to feel all of these things that the book tells them to do. And then they finally say, I guess I must have done it. You told me you have DNA, even though they don't. Or you told me I failed the lie detector, even if I didn't. So I must have done it because these things don't lie. And then you see the trial. So this is just the interrogation. But then you go to trial. And in trial, there's no evidence. All you have is a confession. It's the only thing you have pointing to this person, except maybe they failed their breathalyzer test that night, or maybe they have a past conviction of petty theft, which is in no way related to this conviction of a violent, you know, murder and rape. But for some reason...
Or maybe they're out of a job.
Exactly. Yeah, or it could be just that simple. Like, oh, he was desperate because he's poor.
Right.
And then people go, oh,
he worked at Walmart.
He must be a criminal.
Yeah.
It's so...
he didn't graduate high school or...
So fucked up. It's like they just assassinate their character so much that people think of them as lesser than. Right. And only lesser thans commit violent crimes.
Right. I mean, it happened, too, to Karen Bowes, who in the third or fourth episode, the mother, who is like the age of my mom. And I just, when I looked at her case, I thought, wow, like... The way the courts and the media took down this mom, like, she liked to drink. She was in AA. She wasn't, like, a raging alcoholic. Mm-hmm. She was sober at the time. But in the trial, they brought in her AA sponsor, who kind of violated confidentiality rules at AA and said that she'd said things about her daughter. And they also tried to bring into trial an affair. But it was printed all over the media, wasn't allowed in the trial, but everybody knew
she'd
had an affair
five years
before. And I think her husband had an affair too, but it was really like used to make her look like a bipolar, deranged mother who'd just gone off the rails. And
even though
none of that was true.
Yeah, even though like at least in this case, the judge had the wherewithal to say, like, that's inadmissible because it still fucked her because, of course, we have trial by media.
Yeah. I mean, that's the worst.
It is the worst. But at least, I mean, there's a reason that a good judge would say that's not admissible because it has nothing to do with this case. The fact that she had an affair has nothing to do with whether or not she killed her daughter.
Well, they spin it out as, like, part of her character.
It's exactly.
It shows, like, the lie... That she'd be willing to live or just, there's also things that happen too that people can't control. Like there was another story in the media around that time of a mother who'd burned her kids alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the tiny town where she was near.
Shit.
And it negatively impacted her because then people were on this sort of rage against moms, evil mothers or whatever. I
remember that. There was like a hysteria probably when I was maybe like an adolescent when there were like a lot of moms drowning their kids.
Right.
And I remember it was always in the news. So can you imagine if you were accused of that, even though you didn't do it, like how hard it would be for you to fight against that because there's already a witch hunt.
Right. There's just a lot of unfortunate timing in some of these cases.
Yeah.
Like in the Larry Delisle case, the guy who drove his kids into the river in Detroit, in the Detroit River, there was a lot of reporting about people losing their minds and driving into the water and or driving off a cliff or driving. There were a lot of like sort of death by automobile at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And no one was really asking questions about the car mechanics, if that might be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know where it all landed with some of that, but I know for a fact there were a lot of problems with that car. And
yeah, the fact
make a model car.
Yeah, and the fact that they actually did some tests and it did malfunction within some of those tests is enough evidence to say it could have malfunctioned.
It could have.
I mean, it's reasonable. In my mind, that's what reasonable doubt is.
It could have malfunctioned, yes. It could have. And the thing is, that case is the first case I started with.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is the one that just, I think that one's the hardest one for people. Because it involves kids and because he is culpable because he was driving the car.
Yeah.
But it just was never investigated properly. It was just...
And that's a hard one. You know, we talk about these situations where somebody potentially committed a crime. Is that the right person, did somebody else actually commit the crime? But then there's the stories where it's like, was there even a crime committed or was it just a tragic accident? That happens a lot with fire cases. Mm-hmm. It happened with this car case. I think there's a pretty good documentary called The Staircase, mm-hmm. which is kind of asks that question. Like, did she fall or was she pushed? Mm-hmm. But if she fell, then there's no crime.
Right.
And sometimes, too, there's these political things that are happening in the background. The prosecutor is trying to become the judge or the judge is up for re-election, yeah. or, you know, and all those things can feed into how hard they are on that one case versus this other case. It's just.
And that's all very real.
Yeah. It scares. I mean, it's funny because I find such comfort in science, even though it's not always the most comforting. And even though sometimes I have to remind myself that it's not as clean as I would like it to be. But the criminal justice system in our country, it tries to be objective and it tries to be as fair as it can be, but it has so many problems.
It has a long way to go. And I've learned it's not really willing to correct itself in the face of evidence of needing to make a change. I had this thought because you and I were talking about death and dying mm-hmm. before at dinner, and maybe it has something to do with this sort of American idea that, like, you have to die for a purpose or what, I don't know, like this uncomfortability with death and that tragic accidents don't just happen. And that's not the way the universe works, right? It can't be a tragedy.
We need to blame someone.
Yeah, there's a need for blame mm-hmm. a lot. And I wonder if it's just because we're so uncomfortable with death that we can't just accept that sometimes people just die.
Yeah.
And it happens in really unfortunate, freakish ways.
I think you're right. I think that's a really good insight. It's very difficult for people to handle those kinds of uncomfortable thoughts. And they will figure out any way to give themselves. It's kind of like that moral out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like your own personal moral out. Well, that guy did it. He's responsible. He made there be evil in the world. And if we put him away for life, there'll be a little less evil in the world. It's like, no, the world's kind of dangerous and horrible. That's just sort of what nature is.
And I think that in general, it's hard to accept people being unlucky, but I think there's a lot of unlucky people. And I think in the case of Larry, for instance, like the fact that he was there the night before and the fact that he, you know, this happened on the same road and whatever, there's so much, that fact that he was driving a car his dad committed suicide in, and he's probably the most unlucky person I've ever met.
Yeah.
So I wondered how much of that was just like shitty circumstances.
And I think that that's another thing that, like, again, like from that kind of skeptical worldview, is people don't like admitting that sometimes things are just a coincidence.
Yeah.
It's like they're like, but that's just too much. There must be something tying that together. There must be a thread there. There must be a reason. It's like, no, sometimes things just happen. And it's just a fucking horrible coincidence.
I agree.
Ugh. People do not, that is not a comfortable place for people to sit. Well, okay, I'm taking up a lot of your time and I know that you have someplace that you have to be. So I want to move it along to the way that I generally close the podcast. But first, let's make sure we get a really big plug in for the documentary. I bet you a lot of people listening have already watched it, because I wouldn't be surprised if they have similar Netflix algorithms to me. But if they haven't yet, guys, really do check out the confession tapes. It's, is it a six-parter? I can't remember.
It's seven parts. And I wanted to add, too, that Netflix never releases their data.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know, you probably didn't see the article, because this goes back to the beginning of our conversation where I didn't really know how well the show was doing.
Yeah.
And right before the end of the year, I'm suddenly getting emails from people and just, oh my God, congrats, Kelly, congrats. I'm like, why?
When did it first come out?
In September 8th.
Okay.
So not that long ago, but congrats. Like, oh, great job. And it was like, they released some of their data mm-hmm. in the top 10 most binged watched shows of 2017. It was in the top 10.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So see,
not to brag, but like, I was like, oh.
Yeah. It must be like, so hard when it's not like regular TV and there's no Nielsen rating. And you have no concept.
As I'm not on social media.
Uh-huh.
But the thing I noticed was a good sign was when lawyers in the show wrote me emails and said, people recognize me when I'm walking down the street, or like, I'm at the grocery store and someone's like, I saw you in the confession tapes. And I thought, that's really cool.
That is cool. And it's weird too, because that never happens to you because you're behind the camera.
That's never going to happen to me. Yeah.
But you do, your voice is featured. There are a handful of times that I always love that when you're interviewing somebody and they say something and you're like, yeah, but what do you really think? Like, you can like hear your voice and it's kind of quiet, right? Because you're not mic'd.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, but maybe he didn't do it. And they're like,
Yeah, we debated about whether or not to keep those moments in. I guess you could call it breaking the fourth wall.
I love it. But I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, I was going to get myself in there just for a tiny, tiny second.
That is so funny. But yeah, I know that a lot of people are watching it. I think that there's a hunger for this kind of understanding of how the world works. And I think that as much as it's difficult, it's a responsible and emotionally honest thing to do, to face some of these issues that don't always have a happy ending. And so I think that there's a curiosity in us to learn about other people, especially people who have had a less fortunate kind of situation than we have. I think it helps us understand ourselves a little bit better. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people listening have already seen it. But if you haven't yet, guys, definitely go onto Netflix, just search Confession Tapes. It's really easy to find, and check it out. Kelly, I always end my show by asking people the same two questions. I'm really interested in your answers.
Hope it's not like pop culture.
No, God, no. But there's like really big picture, like philosophy bullshit. So.
Okay.
Okay.
What is it? I'm ready.
Okay. So when you think about the future, in whatever context is like relevant to you in your mind right now, today, whatever, you can answer about your own personal future. You can answer about the future of humanity, you know, whatever. A, or on one side of the coin, what is the thing that most kind of concerns you? Mm-hmm. What keeps you up the most at night? What are you like bummed out about and really worried about when you think about the future? But then on the flip side of that, what are you actually happy and optimistic and really positive about?
Well, can I start with the flip side?
Sure. I usually flip them so that we don't all want to kill ourselves at the end of the show.
Oh, well, maybe that shows a little bit of my character. Because I mean,
you want the good news first, not the bad news.
Well, yeah, I want to end on the depressing note. Yeah, right. Maybe that's like, that's what the show was. It was just all like, oh my God. Well, that's how I felt. And I wanted people to be outraged. So
for sure.
Well, okay. So I'll start with.
Do it your way. You be you.
You be you. Isn't that a book? Isn't there another book called that? Self-help book?
Probably. You be you, girl.
Yeah. You be you. How to get control of your life. Wait, so it was the sort of thing I'm excited about for the future and the thing that I'm most worried about.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah. Super concerned.
Super concerned about.
Yeah.
Well, I guess this idea of fake news is really concerning. And I think I see it in a bigger and just much bigger picture in terms of we have to have something to believe in. Like we have to have some like barometer for truth. And it's not just like a political thing about Trump and him always yelling fake news. It's more just like, I even feel like with all the sexual allegation charges that are coming out are just constantly eroding sense of self as a culture and of this reality that we built. And it's like an identity crisis. And it's bigger than that. It just feels like I'm just worried when there's been so much placed in science that isn't true, isn't valid, isn't tested, when there's so much place in media that isn't completely accurate or is just constantly being challenged. And then you have it in culture and in our sense of like self and how we function every day and just who we are, you know, what we care about. So I think it's having a hard time like gaining a sense of like a ground, you know,
and absolutely
feeling like there's something to hold on to that's like honest and good
and real.
And real.
Yeah, like what's real? What's ethical?
Right.
What matters,
yeah. And it's not just like who you say you are, who you vote for. It's like what you really are and what you stand for. And I just feel like there's a bit of a crisis with that. And it even extends into science, which is the most troubling part for me because science is not supposed to feel shaky.
I know, right? Like science is self-correcting and science is sometimes wrong, but we put so much of our trust in the institution that sometimes we will trust the wrong people or we will trust the wrong exercises, like mm-hmm. things that are called science are actually not very scientific.
Right.
And then people are led really astray.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that worries me, especially when it's used in a criminal court.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, specifically I'm worried about that. I'm worried about all the people who maybe were prosecuted on faulty science. Mm-hmm. That's like a smaller worry, I guess. Like, the bigger worry is how that ripples, how these this stories put out have rippled through the rest of society on just every level.
Yeah, that's sort of abstract. It happening in the courtroom is like a microcosm.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, what's
happening. It's a bigger crisis, I think.
Absolutely.
And it's just like the reckoning that we have to have with it, which is going to be hard. It's kind of the reckoning we had when Trump was elected and the reckoning we had with the sexual allegations. I mean, we're just constantly like trying to find that the middle, like the ground, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it, but. And then I guess like positive, like, I mean.
You're like, what, optimistic?
Optimistic.
No. What is this word?
Well, I guess I'm happy to be alive because it's like such a short thing anyway.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of crazy to be alive and to be doing this kind of work even. And I think, I mean, I'm just so inspired by some of the incarcerated people that I've met and like their perseverance and their strength of mind and just the intellect. I'm constantly just amazed at how powerful the mind is and how it can fight a lot of evil and it can make comebacks and after much time, after much despair, it's resilient. So I don't know. And then all the great lawyers that I've met so many good people that just don't give up. So
it's comforting.
It's really comforting. It's inspiring. It's made me even question, like, well, how can I be most impactful? Mm-hmm. Like, is making this work the best use of my energy? Maybe there's something else that I could do. And I'm not like talking about like volunteering once a week or raising money or anything. I don't know. I just have felt lately that I want to like put my money where my mouth is and like do more. I don't know.
I think that's one additional bonus of educating ourselves and opening our eyes to these kinds of issues and being able to watch documentaries like the one you made is that it reminds us that we have skin in the game too. And it keeps us from being complacent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's really easy to live your like sanitized life and pretend like that nothing, injustice doesn't exist.
Right.
And then when you're faced with it head on, you're like, shit, like
yeah.
crap. Like I've been sort of living a little bit a lie and I need to like be mindful of the fact that like I have it pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable to the extent, if we are, that I can maybe help people that are less comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's just being a good juror.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many ways that we can like affect the way the system works.
Yeah.
Even though it seems so much bigger than us. But I've seen like people do things that are really like tangible and like really, or just sort of tactile good things. I don't know. I think there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of optimism, but it just requires a lot of energy to go after it.
Yeah. That's for sure. Especially in the era of Trump. Well, Kelly, thank you so much. This was so much fun to catch up with you. I always enjoy your company so much, but I learned a lot. And yeah, I'm inspired now myself.
I learned a lot from you. I've missed you.
Me too. And guys, everyone listening, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.